Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's programme, a conversation with the playwright Rogelio Martinez. The Arden Theatre presents the world premiere production of his Wanamaker's Pursuit as part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts. Susan Lewis considers two early 20th century artists whose work in Paris has inspired collaborations in that festival. Eric Brannan takes us to Pennypacker Mills in Schwanksville, PA for an exhibition of historical mechanical musical devices, the forerunners to modern electronic appliances like the CD player and the iPod. And the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns profiles the Scottish composer James Macmillan. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The remit for artists and organizations participating in the first Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts was to produce work inspired by the radical shift in approaches to music and the arts that happened in Paris 100 years ago. Among the presentations most faithful to this idea is the Arden Theatre's latest production. In Wanamaker's Pursuit, the Cuban-American playwright Rogelio Martinez tells the story of Nathan Wanamaker, who goes to Paris on a buying trip for his family's department store and discovers a whole new, exotic world. When I spoke with Rogelio Martinez at the Arden Theatre, I first asked him about the genesis of the play. How specific had the Arden been in describing the subject matter when they commissioned the work?
Well, part of the commission was the Arden, and then the other part was the Philadelphia International Festival for the Arts. It was a celebration of Paris at the beginning of the 20th century. And so I had to work within those parameters. And I started to look at Paris, 1911, and what was happening at that time. And I was discovering that it was a really exciting time. Most of us think of Paris in the 20s. But in order to get to Paris in the 20s, a lot had to happen to these young people in Paris in the teens. And so I was interested in people like Gertrude Stein, people like Leo Stein, people like Picasso, as they were maturing and they were becoming the people we would come to know.
I remember John Lennon being interviewed in the 1970s and asked why he'd left his beloved England to go and live in New York, and his reply was that if he'd lived in Roman times, he would have gone to live in Rome. You're an immigrant who lives in New York, so clearly you understand why immigrants travel to the Rome of their day. Paris was the Rome of the early 20th century. Why was that?
I think because so much was changing in the way that we looked at art. There was, of course, all this tradition going on, but there were these artists that were challenging the conventions of the time. Picasso, for example, one of the things that was interesting to do was read the reviews, how critics were reviewing him. They weren't kind to him.
Nor to many of the artists. Many of them were reviled.
Totally. And so there was these forces that were really responsible for saying, hey, take a look at these people. These people are important. These people are going to matter in the future. And Gertrude Stein was one of them. Leo Stein, her brother, was another. Those two really, really forced us to come to terms with what was coming.
Any creative process hopefully will change the audience in ways. What changed in you as a consequence of the journey of writing this play?
I didn't think I was going to fall in love with Paris the way I did. You know what it is? I didn't realize that I was going to be writing about the immigrant experience. I didn't realize I was going to be writing about myself, actually. I thought I was going to be writing about a young man who goes to Paris.
Yeah, but you were 9 when you came here. It wasn't your decision.
It wasn't my decision. But I haven't been back. And the idea that you see the world afresh, you see the world with new eyes. I remember in those first 9 years, I remember Cuba quite well. And I remember my experiences in Cuba. I remember what it felt like the first time I saw snow. I remember what it felt like the first time I tried to make a snowman. And I just remember those experiences. And so even though this is about a young man who goes to Paris in 1911, it's still infused with the wonder of, oh my God, this is a new place. I'm falling in love again.
What would you like audiences to take away from this? I mean, clearly a great yarn, but is there a moral or a philosophical lesson, or how can the audience be changed then by this?
Roger Ebert, there's a quote from Roger Ebert where he talks about La Ventura, one of my favorite films, and he says that every 10 years or so he returns to a university, I forget which university, to screen the film for the students. And every 10 years he sees a different film. He experiences a different film. So I think that once the audience watches the play, I have no control what they're going to take away, nor do I want to have that control. That's part of the excitement. And I suspect that 10, 15 years from now, when I see the play again, I'm going to take something different away from it. And I'm going to want that audience to walk away with something different. So, yes, you know, so I know that doesn't answer your question right on, spot on, but I do believe that theater is such a collaborative art form. And someone else once said that at some point the play belongs just to you, and at some point it belongs to the director and you, and at some point it belongs to you, the actors, but at some point it belongs to the audience. And when it belongs to the audience, then they're going to take something away from it, and I'm going to watch them take that, and I'm going to learn from that. That's why we have previews as well, so I can answer these difficult questions.
Do we have another Paris now, or could we have another Paris?
Will we ever have another Paris? I hope so, and I'm wondering if it's somewhere in the digital world right now, and we don't know it, because I think it could exist somewhere. I'm only mentioning the digital world because it's something that I'm less familiar with. So nothing's changed so radically in New York. And people will say, yes, things have changed. But when you have had Picassos and de Kooning's and Giacometti's, I suspect it's happening somewhere in the digital world. And someday we'll look back and say, my God, there was a whole subculture out there in the digital world that was creating something, and we were ignoring it.
And changing the world.
And changing the world, absolutely.
Playwright Rogelio Martinez. The Arden Theatre's world premiere production of his Wanamaker's Pursuit runs through May 28th as part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The bold new art that came out of Paris in the early 20th century was, as we've just heard, often made by artists as colourful as their creations. The ongoing Philadelphia Festival of the Arts includes two collaborations between dance and theatre artists that draw attention to two distinctive personalities. The Wilma and Ballet X are presenting a work based on Guillaume Apollinaire's surrealist play The Breast of Tiresias, and a joint dance and theatre project at Temple University showcases the life of the African-American entertainer Josephine Baker. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers these two 20th century artists the inspirations behind two new 21st century works.
Italian-born Guillaume Apollinaire and African-American Josephine Baker never met. Apollinaire died in 1918. Baker first came to Paris in 1926. But each of them, from humble beginnings, reinvented themselves and hit the big time, and while making their own artistic statements, drew others to them. And each personified some of the most important aspects of the period. Wanting to work together in a joint response to PIFA, the Wilma Theater and its resident dance company, Ballet X, chose to reinterpret Apollinaire's 1917 play, The Breasts of Tiresias. Dramaturg Walter Bilderbach is adapting the work.
Much of the adaptation has been to find ways to blend acting and dancing with it. So some characters in the original who have lines are now just danced.
Apollinaire was born Wilhelm Apollinaris de Kostrowitzki in 1880 in Rome to a Polish mother. He was raised in Monte Carlo and moved to Paris when he was 20.
He never knew exactly who his father was, created the name Guillaume Apollinaire for himself, and in his early 20s emerged as a major poet and art critic.
In modern parlance, he was a great networker. He introduced Picasso and Braque and was an early advocate of Matisse. Bilderbach says he knew everyone.
Apollinaire collected people around him because he seems to have kind of loved people, and if someone was talented, he wanted to help make everyone aware of how talented they were.
He liked people, but also ideas, and was a passionate artist on his own. He was a poet and created shape poetry with handwritten words placed strategically on the page.
Where a poem about a horse looks like the front end of a horse, a poem about a fountain looks like water bursting up into the air.
In addition to his poetry, Apollinaire wrote art criticism and commentary and is credited with coining the term surrealist. He wrote the play The Breasts of Tiresias while he was recovering from wounds suffered on the battlefield of World War I.
In his preface to The Breasts of Tiresias, he tries to define it at one point by saying when a man wanted to imitate a leg, he created a wheel which doesn't resemble a leg at all. At the same time, he was practicing surrealism without knowing it.
The play, says Bilderbach, is partly about gender bending and is loosely drawn on the Greek myth of the prophet Tiresias, who is turned into a woman for 7 years.
And becomes the only human being who knows whether men or women like sex better.
Apollinaire's story begins with a married woman, Therese, who, upset with the limited choices available to women in the early 20th century, magically turns into a man.
Her husband tries to object to it. She essentially beats him up, dresses him in her dress, and goes off to become a minister, a general, all the things that men can do. And the husband decides that men can produce children themselves without women. And end of Act 1. Come back in Act 2 later in the afternoon, and he has had 40,049 babies that afternoon.
Apollinaire died in 1918 at age 38, a year after the premiere of The Breasts of Tiresias. The story would later become the basis of a 1947 opera by French composer Francis Poulenc. After the war, many who had left Paris returned, and new artists joined the once again thriving art scene.
J'ai deux amours.
The club culture provided work for musicians, singers, and dancers, among them Josephine Baker, an African-American entertainer from St. Louis, Missouri. Her life is now the focus of a dance and theater collaboration at Temple University, with a work created by associate theater professor Kamika Williams-Witherspoon and choreographer and chair of the dance department, Kariamu Welsh.
I wanted to focus on Josephine Baker because I felt it was very important to really highlight an African-American who sort of bridged this American-French connection.
Josephine Baker sang, danced, and acted.
She was an African-American woman who, long before we had equality in America, became this French sensation and an equal. Because of her notoriety and her fame, a lot of expatriates that we know of also came to see her, people like James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, Paul Robeson. So she became a magnet for many African Americans who wanted to see what it was like to live, in a sense, free.
Born Frida Josephine McDonald, after dropping out of school and dancing in St. Louis vaudeville, she had married twice, moved to New York, and become Josephine Baker while still in her teens. Finding work in a chorus line on Broadway, she was invited to France by a producer who saw her in Ubi Blake's 1921 production of Shuffle Along. It was in Paris that she became a star. The consummate entertainer, she caused a stir with her banana dance.
She literally wore a string of bananas around her waist, and that was her costume. And the men went crazy, but the women loved her as well. And she was not afraid to go what we call topless. People say, why are you going naked? She says, I'm not naked. She says, I just don't have any clothes on.
Baker's presence in Paris coincided with a period when Europeans had become fascinated with Africa. University of Pennsylvania art history professor Christine Poggi says African art was a hot commodity among fine artists.
In Paris, it was being sold in certain galleries. André Durin had a mask that he purchased that he showed Picasso. And we know that later Picasso purchased African masks. Matisse was also looking at African masks.
And while Josephine Baker's dancing had nothing to do with Africa,
I think that Josephine Baker was able to parlay the interest in Africa, the sort of desire and lust for all things African, and she did not mind playing into that sort of stereotype in a way.
Baker's success paved the way for African Americans who would come after.
People like Lena Horne, Dorothy Dandridge, so there were musicals like Stormy Weather, which you had Bill Robinson, who's known as Bill Bojangles. So she made the way for them. And also the idea of a black person becoming a star was something that she helped to solidify, and being paid top-notch wages for what she did. I mean, dressing in all the glamorous clothes. And she proved to many aspiring dancers, actors, that it was possible, even from a poor, as she says, skinny girl from St. Louis, Missouri.
In the decades that followed, although she lived in France and became a French citizen, Baker supported the American Civil Rights Movement, appearing with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1963 March on Washington. Her personal life mirrored her vision of equality.
She was concerned about blacks in America. She did want to adopt all these children from different races because she saw in the French model at that time that there was an acceptance of all kinds of people, and she wanted her family, and eventually there were 12 children she adopted, to represent, in a sense, all the races.
Josephine Baker and Guillaume Apollinaire may seem to have little in common, yet these artists, who flourished in early 20th century Paris, personified the energy of the period. Both combined artistic talent with a commitment to greater social good, challenged the status quo while embracing their heritage, and envisioned a future that could be ever brighter for those yet to come.
And both have inspired new works of art nearly 100 years later. WRTI's Susan Lewis. Proliferation of the Imagination, a collaboration between the Wilma Theatre and Ballet X, runs through April 24th. La Baker, The Life and Times of Josephine Baker, is at the Conwell Dance Theatre at Temple University on Wednesday and Thursday evening. Both productions are part of the Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts, which runs through May 1st. Today, listening to music requires little more than tuning a dial in the car, a few clicks of a mouse, or even the press of a button on an MP3 player. However, it wasn't always so easy. Now WRTI's Eric Brannan takes us to Pennypacker Mills in Schwanksville, PA, and an exhibition of antique music boxes and other self-playing musical instruments. They tell a story about the development of devices that allow non-musicians to play music.
At the start of the 19th century, if you wanted to hear music in your home, you needed a musical instrument and someone to play it. Then, along came the music box. Their popularization made it possible to hear the tunes of the day at an affordable price with just the crank of a handle. They were invented using technology that had been in churches for centuries.
If you wanted to have a service and you didn't have an organist, who's going to play the organ?
Carl Klaes is assistant administrator at Pennypacker Mills and curator of Wind It Up and Hear It Play, mechanical music of the 19th century.
So with a barrel organ, it's a large barrel with all types of pins and staples that is turned by a crank. And there's a bellows inside that'll blow the air through the pipes, and the pins on the barrels will open up the notes.
The instruments on view at the Pennypacker Museum illustrate the evolution of musical technologies through the 19th and early 20th century. On display are crank-operated organs like this roller organ, a tabletop machine which also used a cylinder dotted with pins to correspond with certain notes on the main instrument. Using pins to map out a sequence of notes is not unlike simple computer programming, and this availability of popular music on easily interchangeable cylinders was a precursor to the recording industry.
Whenever a Broadway show would come out, people would produce it on piano music and organ music. So, you know, you want to buy the most popular shows. And so when the same thing comes out on rolls and roller organs or on the music box, it is from the very beginning, music industry.
Playing these songs on a music box was made especially convenient in the 1880s, when the American company Regina invented a music box that used interchangeable metal discs. These discs resemble LP records, but with punched holes rather than pressed grooves. But But by the time this was invented, the market for different kinds of music playing devices was getting pretty crowded.
It's like today, you know, you might have a CD player, you might have a tape player, you have the radio. Things come down to what you can afford.
Such was the case in Pennypacker Mills, the one-time home of Samuel Pennypacker, Pennsylvania's governor from 1903 to 1907. A wealthy man, he owned both a piano and one of the Regina music boxes on display in the exhibition. Assistant administrator at the museum, Linda Caligari, says that their ease of use and portability made the music box a popular choice for entertaining guests.
When you had company in those parlors, or maybe it's on the porch in the summertime, because that was your outdoor living room. And so you could have music playing while people sat on wicker furniture or laid in the hammock and looked out over the meadow. You would play that as a one more aspect of the entertainment for those guests. It would be very typical of the time period. It reflects kind of how people did things.
But as these music boxes gained in popularity, Thomas Edison was developing something that would ultimately lead to their decline.
In 1877, he was coming up with a way to record telephone messages. And in the process, he'll invent a phonograph. And his music was engraved into a cylinder. And these are, you know, a direct recording.
The ability to record and reproduce real sounds, voices, instruments, and even a music box itself signaled the impending demise of the mechanical music player. With the rise of radio, a manufacturing industry dominated by the needs of World War I and the lack of luxuries during the Great Depression, music boxes and their counterparts had become little more than artifacts by the 1930s. And yet, they're still around today. Not competing with CDs or iPods, but doing what they've always done, producing soothing tones and soft clicks, making musical sounds as individual as they are, a distinct musical instrument, and not just a recording of one. And as everybody knows, hearing a recording of something is never the same as the real thing.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. Wind it up and hear it play. Mechanical music of the 19th century is at Pennypacker Mills in Schwanksville, PA. It runs through September 1st. The latest violin concerto by the Scottish composer James Macmillan was co-commissioned by three European ensembles and the Philadelphia Orchestra. The US premieres of the work earlier this year at the Kimmel Center in Carnegie Hall saw the Philadelphia Orchestra chanting in German and even spouting poetry. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns sought an explanation from the composer without much success, but found that Macmillan had lots to say on other matters.
If music is thoroughly explainable in words, you probably wouldn't need to hear it. If creativity had airtight logic, the result would be science, not art. Even with that caveat, James Macmillan's work has a number of features that warrant explanation but also defy it. The dedication of his violin concerto to the memory of his deceased mother accounts for the inclusion of some folksy moments in the middle movement, the songs she sang to him as a child. But in the third movement, when the orchestra members suddenly start counting in German,
the German stuff really has nothing to do with my mum. I really don't know where that's come from, actually. It's a kind of mystery thing that just came in a dream or two. And a couple of kind of daydreams and as well as night dreams. You can't really explain everything. I'm not being obtuse. I would honestly tell them if there was something to tell.
At its world premiere in England last year, many critics seemed to resent something that they so couldn't explain. Well, at least the concerto will always be noticed. Though Macmillan is one of the UK's most active composers, having written three symphonies, lots of choral works, and even concertos, all of which receive high-profile performances, taking on a violin concerto meant facing down some of the most perfect works by the great composers.
I had worried about writing a violin concerto because there's great violin concertos in the repertoire already, And it tends to be that when that happens, that the modern works are edged out of the repertoire. So my most played concertos so far have been the percussion concerto and the cor anglais, or the English horn concerto, because they're unusual, really. I had to be courageous about the violin concerto.
As for the chanting, it's not the first time he's tried something like this.
I've written a piece called The Scotch Bestiary, where the orchestra sing in the middle of it. And in the places I've done it, including Toronto, the players were fine with it and they sang. There's an amen chorus that they sang, and then a couple of chords where they've got to pick notes out of the air, and they did it. They were really game for it.
Well, it is music about a collection of beasts and fierce ones from the country that gave us Braveheart. As successful as the 51-year-old Macmillan is at this point, he's still an outsider, at least temperamentally, and if anything, becomes more ruggedly individualistic with the passing years. The closest his training came to the cultural mainstream of London was the University of Manchester, and he continues to live in Scotland. But while composers such as Peter Maxwell Davies find musical stimulation in the wind, rain, and people of the Orkney Islands north of Scotland, Macmillan made his name on music drawn from ancient legends and not the cute ones. In fact, Macmillan's first piano concerto took its title, The Berserking, from the Viking warriors that worked themselves into a pre-battle frenzy that wasn't always good for accomplishing the ordeal ahead. That was his ticket to a modern musical language. And the nature stuff? Well, maybe later.
It might be a hangover from my kind of earlier modernist hang-up about being influenced by nature as something that was old-fashioned in the 19th century. But as I've got older, I've got to care less about that and actually embrace the 19th century much more.
Those who come to Macmillan with little prior knowledge might be surprised to discover that the author of this tough, ceaselessly arresting music is, at heart, a religious composer. He often writes music with sacred texts, but the result isn't what you'd hear from, say, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Even Macmillan's more traditional choral works have a climactic high note that the sopranos can just barely reach and not hold on to for very long. In his St. John Passion, the death of Christ has no typical minor chords and heart-rending pathos, but an eerie, quiet strangeness. Unlike John Taverner and Arvo Pärt, the religious music of James Macmillan doesn't have a soothing, ethereal sense of certainty.
It's interesting you should draw attention to a minimalist like Pärt, but it ignores a huge hinterland in our culture of religious music. It has nothing to do with that modern simplicity at all. No, music with a strong dialectic, music where there's thesis, antithesis, synthesis. It's straight out of the Western tradition that embraces complexity, and I feel very much more at home with that.
Though he can be a rather vocal public figure in matters of Scottish politics and social issues, he lives in Glasgow with his wife, three children, and one granddaughter, and from the outside, at least, his life appears to be quite typical. This is not unusual among composers. Many have gone on their wildest musical adventures when their home lives were the most stable. What seems to come from a tortured life, in fact, emanates from a fairly happy one. Still, when listening to some of Macmillan's crushing harmonic clashes, you wonder, doesn't writing this music hurt?
It is exhausting, but it is exhilarating. I love being a composer, I have to say. No day's the same, and some days can be quite mundane and domestic, and I love that. And other days are just very, very unexpected and transcendental almost, and you never know when that's going to happen. But it's the nice combination that I find is a very pleasant kind of work.
Like Brahms, Macmillan is increasingly writing works that are of this world, but refer to it only incidentally. Just for the sake of argument, I listened to the rather graphically descriptive final movement of the violin concerto. I heard people counting, there were bits of percussion that seemed borrowed from Chinese opera, some trumpets with wah-wah mutes added a bit of comedy, but I don't know what it means, and I don't care. Good music is processed through the brain, but the best music bypasses it, and goes to more important places.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.